Okay, this evening, as I say, we're going to be in Matthew chapters 23 and 24. I felt last week that I just really didn't quite have enough time to finish up with Matthew 24, so tormented myself trying to decide if I should spend a whole class on it or not. Figured probably that I would. I realize you're probably having an overdose on this by now. It's been 4 weeks as of tonight with one chapter, two if you count Matthew 23. But I am just utterly convinced, brothers, as I've said so many times, that a firm grasp of Matthew 23 and 24 will just help us enormously when we do get to Revelation, which will be next week. We'll be getting started there, maybe a little bit even this evening. So open up your Bibles to Matthew 23 and 24, bearing in mind that 40% of America, the last count in recent census, 2010 I think it was, 40% of America believes that somewhere in Matthew 23 and 24, though most would say not in 23, but in 24, Jesus is going to talk about a second topic. Most everybody agrees, I think everybody agrees, that he does talk about the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, one of the most significant events in world history, which took place in September of 70 AD, after a 3.5-year siege by the Roman armies. So terrible that the Jews were forced in starvation to start cannibalizing themselves inside that city. The stories of what went on in the 3.5 years of their turmoil as Rome was attacking them are all recorded by Josephus in the Wars of the Jews, and also in the Antiquities, two books that he wrote. Josephus was an eyewitness. Josephus then, not being a Christian and being a Pharisee, is a great witness for us of what first century Jews were thinking. He was born about the time Jesus died, so at the events of 70 AD, he would have been just about 40 years old. He was not only a Pharisee, but a Roman general, and a man then who was eminently qualified to write about the things he saw. In all of world history, and this is not an exaggeration, in world history, his book, The Wars of the Jews, is one of the single most important historical records of the Antiquities that is known to man. There's just very few even that can rival it. So we've been looking at some of the things that Josephus had said that corroborate the things that Jesus had said. You have a man who is in effect a hostile witness, but he's demonstrating that the things that Jesus said did come to pass. Now, he doesn't reference Jesus. He doesn't say Jesus told the truth. He doesn't say he foretold the future. The man was not a Christian. It's not about him identifying Jesus. It is him independently just simply recording a history that verifies everything Jesus said came to pass. Now, in Matthew chapter 23, it all starts with this chapter-long condemnation of the scribes and Pharisees who were hypocrites. And of course, by extension, those followers, the evil people that embrace their false doctrine and their horrifically immoral behavior. In verse 13 of Matthew 23, you have the first of the 8 times that Jesus uses that formula, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from men, for you do not enter in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in." Then, I won't read every one of them, just the headline there. In verse 14 is the second one, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you devour widows' houses." Verse 15 is the third, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you travel about on sea and land to make one proselyte, when he becomes one, you make twice as much a son of Gehenna as yourselves." Verse 16 is number 4, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold, he's obligated." Skipping down to number 5 in verse 23, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and neglect the weightier matters of the law." Number 6 in 25, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you clean the outside of the cup and you know the rest." And then number 7 in verse 27, "You are like whitewashed tombs," equally famous. Which brings us to number 8 in verse 29. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had been living in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. Consequently, you bear witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers." Jesus is saying, you're liars. You say you would not persecute prophets. You already have. In a couple of days, they're going to kill Jesus, and he knows it right well. This is probably the Thursday, maybe the Wednesday, before Jesus goes to the cross. It's just a matter of hours, a couple of days. These are murderous men, just like their fathers. And they will do all in their power to destroy Christianity, first in the Christ, and then in his people who are about to follow. So, in verse 32, "Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how shall you escape the sentence of Gehenna?" We talked about that word. It references the Valley of Hinnom. It's a physical place right next to the walls of Jerusalem. It is where the idolatry that to Molech had taken place in Old Testament times, where they had offered their children as living sacrifices, where God condemned them as performing the most abominable acts, you know, known to man. There is a sentence for that, and that sentence for that kind of behavior is death. Well, that's what Jesus is about to say in verse 34 and following. "Behold, I'm sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may fall all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation." Now, brethren, everybody in every religious group, every Bible student accepts verse 36 as being a reference to the then living people of that time, and a reference to the fall of Jerusalem. Siege begins in 66, ends in 70 with the burning of the temple and its dismantling. "So truly I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation" is fully understood by everybody as what it means. What it means is, everything I just told you is going to come to pass before all of you people die. It's going to come to pass in this time frame, in the lives of this group of people that I'm talking to. So now he's told them when, that's this generation in verse 36. It's why has been given in 34 and 35, because you murdered the prophets just like your fathers, and you're going to continue to do so in the years to come. The where is given in verse 37. "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling." So there is the city that is rejecting the compassion, the mercy, the overtures, the loving kindness of God our Father as manifested in Jesus our Lord, Emmanuel, who is God with us. They will not have him, no matter he'd spent 3.5 years raising the dead, walking on water, stilling storms, healing every disease there was, and just showing with incontrovertible proof that he is the promised one, the Son of the living God, the Messiah. Then in verse 38, he gives us the what is going to happen. "Behold, your house is being left to you desolate." The house can refer either to the nation itself, the house of Israel, or to the temple itself, which is the house of God in Jerusalem. I think truly both of those are involved there. You don't have to separate them and pick one. Both are true. And the apostles are going to pick up on the idea that he's talking about the temple. So it's very clear from what follows. We'll read it in just a moment. When they heard this phrase, they thought he was referencing the temple. You'll find from looking at Mark chapter 13 and Luke 21, I think also, that Jesus was in the temple. the story of the widow's mite had taken place just moments before what he said in Matthew chapter 23. And then he concludes that chapter, as the chapters are broken, the chapter concludes in 39, I say to you, from now on you shall not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Somebody is coming in the name of the Lord. And the seeing that we're talking about here is not with your eyes. He had told them they were blind on more than one occasion in the preceding verses of this chapter. They were blind guides. They were blind to who Jesus was. They were blind to what God was accomplishing in him. They didn't see him. They didn't understand him. They had eyes, you know, that could see but not perceive, which was an expression Jesus used on another occasion. So, here's the warning. Based on the sins and the rejection of Jesus, you will be responsible for the blood of all the apostles and prophets. It'll happen in this generation, in this city. It'll happen so that you will fall prey to the punishment for having rejected not only your Messiah, but your God and all of those who are the prophets. Now comes chapter 24. The apostles get it. They're upset about it. They can't hardly imagine it. The fall of the temple would involve, in their eyes, of course, the end of the entire Jewish system. No more sacrifices, no more priesthood. They would lose, you know, everything that identified them as the chosen people of God. So they're stunned. They're distraught. And in verse 1, Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. So now he's walked from inside the temple to the outside of the temple. From the inside, of course, you see the glory and its wealth, really. From the outside, you see the magnificence, the size of the structure, how imposing it was, truly a wonder of the world at that time. And in verse 2, he answered and said to them, do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another which will not be torn down. That is not a reference to going to heaven. It is not a reference to the end of the world. It is a reference to the dismantling, the deconstruction, the demolition, the desolation of the house of Israel, their temple. That's what they're pointing at. That's what he said you could see. It's the stones here that we're talking about. Now, in verse 3, they're still upset. About 15 minutes, maybe, has transpired. They've walked down out of the Temple Mount through the little Kidron Valley, which I've told you I've done myself. Couldn't take more than about 15 minutes to walk down the gentle slope of one side and up the other, really, really close. I think it's even a full half a mile that you'd have to walk. And so, now in verse 3, as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, showed you a wonderful picture, both a photograph as well as an artist's conception of the view from Mount Olivet, or the Mount of Olives. As you are on that hill, you have an elevation of a couple of hundred feet over the Temple Mount. You look across that tiny little valley we just talked about. You can look right at the full features and glory, the majesty of that temple. It's just the best view in Israel. And so there it is, just laid right out in front of you in all of its glory. And so he's sitting on the Mount of Olives. They can see it across the way. And the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? What are the only things they've been talking about in the whole chapter 23? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you will not escape the sentence of Gehenna. Upon you will fall the blood of all that have been shed on the earth from Abel to Zechariah. It'll happen in this generation. It'll happen in this city. And what it will be is that not one stone here will be left upon another. So in verse 4, or 3 rather, how many questions did they ask? Two. Not three. Only two. Second one has two parts, but it's still only one question. It's just a compound question. Fact of the matter is, they want to know, when will these things be? He'll answer that question at verse 14. In verse 14, directly, he says, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached to the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. What is the Greek word for world in verse 14?
Oikoumene. You were supposed to write it down. Oikoumene. We went over and we looked at Luke chapter 2 and verse 1, and at Acts chapter 19 and verse 27, and then at the testimony of Josephus, who in both biblical terms and in uninspired historical terms identify the boundaries of the Roman Empire as being the oikoumene that they're talking about. They are talking about the Roman world, not the Eskimo world. They're talking about the Roman world, not the Chinese world. Talking about the Roman world, not the Indonesian world. That world is the world, the oikoumene, of that time. So we did a whole word study on that. Does not refer to planet, never has referred to planet, and got anything to do with the globe. Not talking about a universal destruction of this, the planet Earth. Then they asked a two-part question, a single question with two parts, at the remainder of verse 3. What will be the sign? We want to know what that one single sign is. Sign is in the singular, not the plural. They ask for a sign. What is the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? The sign of his coming is the sign of the end of the age. They are one and the same sign. What's the sign? And the sign is answered in verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. He who is on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. Woe to those who are with child and those who nurse babes in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. For then, that is at that time, in those days, there will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the cosmos, that is the word you'd use for the whole planet. So in all history, he's saying, since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short. Now we studied all of this in last week's class. I'm just trying to help this young lady out. Oh my God, I intended fully to do this whole review, but now you get the full meal deal too. That's first time with us tonight. So, what do we have? We have Jesus saying, you scribes and Pharisees are hypocrites, and you and everything you stand for is coming down. It's coming down in this generation, in this city, because you have murdered the prophets just like your fathers before you, and you're going to murder more than I'm about to send to you, and I'm holding you accountable for all of them. So then, not one stone here will be left upon another. Your house is left to you desolate. The apostles are amazed. They ask two questions. When and what's the sign? The sign of his coming is of the end of the what? Age. What is the last word in verse 3 in Greek? You could actually pronounce it a couple of different ways. Ion is the way I know it. In English, that word has become for us what? Eon. It's our word, eon. We got it directly from the Greek. What eon means to you is what ion meant to them. They are one and the same. Does the word have anything to do with physical substances? No. It is what kind of a word? What kind of a reference? What does it refer to? Time. Not stuff, but a time. The Jews, these apostles, recognize you take away our temple, you are taking away the time of Moses. You are taking away the time of the Jews. You are taking away the time of the Mosaic Covenant. You are taking away our ability to practice our religion as the chosen people of God. You are taking away everything from us. It's the end of our age. It's the end of our time. It's the end of this eon. So, Jesus, in verses 4 through 13, tells them what the sign is not. So I'm not going to review all of that. We went through it all. He told them, don't get upset about that. You're going to see all these things. So we get an idea that, since all this stuff's going to happen in this generation, that some years are going to go by. Most people think in terms of 40 years as being a generation. You know, that's fine with me. It happens to be the exact time frame we have right here. But, you know, God never defines it as 42 years as opposed to 41. You know, something like that. It's a general word, but it has to do, generation, with the people that are living in a given moment. So now, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. The end comes at the end of these verses 3 through 13, where all this stuff will be happening for years in this generation. But don't get upset about those things. The end won't come until they've all gone down, and then the gospel's preached. Gospel of the kingdom is preached in the whole oikumene. Where does the Bible say when the gospel was preached in the entire oikumene? Where's the Bible verse in the New Testament that tells us whether or not and when verse 14 was fulfilled? When was the gospel of the kingdom preached in the whole world? Give me a verse. Okay. Get your pencils out again. The verses you need are Romans chapter 1, verse 8. Romans 1, 8. And Romans 10, verse 18. Now, as a matter of fact, I seem to have one of those myself, but I think I wrote all this down for you on the page in the Revelation syllabus that is numbered 14. And I probably put that down where? If all those verses are there. They are. Right dead center in the middle of the page where it says Matthew 24, 14 through 28, when the end shall come, accomplished by 62 AD when Paul wrote Colossians. 1:5, 1:6, and 1:23 in Colossians. I only gave you Romans 10, 18 in the notes. Romans 1, 8 says the same thing. That gospel of that kingdom was preached in that oikumene in that generation. Because in two different letters, Paul says so. He says so in the Colossian letter written in 62 AD. He says so in the Roman letter written in 57 AD. And 9 years from the Roman letter, in a matter of only 4 years from the Colossian letter, that is, in that generation and near and right after all the things in verses 3 through 13, then in fact, brethren, God declared in heaven apparently, the gospel has been preached in all of the oikumene, and now the end of the age shall come. And brethren, it came in such a spectacular and appalling and horrifying and amazing way that Josephus' Wars of the Jews has gone down in history to this day as one of the most marvelous historical works ever, describing in minute detail the fulfillment of this prophecy. Somebody tell me in verse 15 how you could prove with a Bible verse what the abomination of desolation was so that we're not speculating, you know, reading Left Behind books and getting misled and leaving the truth behind. Where do we go? Greg? You turn to Luke's account. What chapter is Luke? 21. And the verses are 20 through 24. So everybody, Luke 21, verses 20 through 24. The parallel account, the exact same event. Luke is telling the same story that Matthew did. Jesus spoke a lot of words there that Matthew doesn't record. Some of the words that Matthew didn't tell us about, Luke does. Jesus also said on the same occasion as Matthew 24, but as recorded by Luke in chapter 21 of his gospel, Jesus said this, starting in verse 20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her what is at hand? What was the penalty at the end of Matthew 23? Your house will be left desolate. What was the sign in Matthew 24:15? The abomination of desolation is coming. In Matthew 24:15, what should you do when you see the abomination of desolation? Flee. If you're in Judea, go to the hills. If you're in the field, don't come back. If you're pregnant or with nursing, it's going to be terrible. Pray it's not in the winter. You have to run away from Jerusalem. In Luke 21:20, he said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of the city depart, and let not those who are in the country enter the city. Because these are days of what? Vengeance. What had he said in Matthew 23? Upon you will fall all the guilt for the blood shed from where to where? From Abel to Zechariah. These are days of vengeance, in order that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Woe to those who are with child, to those who nurse babes in those days, and there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. They'll fall by the edge of the sword, not the end of the world, and will be led captive, not the end of the world, into all the nations, which still have a world to live in. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. That has happened. So, where Matthew says, you'll see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, brethren, what's the holy place? Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. What does Luke say Jesus also said? When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, run. Okay? Now, back to Matthew 24. In Matthew chapter 24 now, we have worked our way down to verse 23, where it says, then, if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe him. For false Christ and false prophets will arise and will show great sign and wonder, so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I've told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, behold, he's in the wilderness, do not go forth. Or behold, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe him. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the what of the Son of Man be. The coming of the Son of Man. What was it that he said at the very end of chapter 23? Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. What was the question they asked in verse 3 of Matthew 24? What will be the sign of your coming? They're wondering about when Jesus is going to come to end the age. He is going to do that by an agent. He is going to send that Roman army to do that. When you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, you know I have come. You know that judgment has come. You know that guilt for the blood is now going to be avenged. You know that the time is up. So now, in verse 27, just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. You can't miss it. You don't hide lightning. It fills the whole sky. So, if somebody says, I'm coming back in some secret way, like, for instance, Jehovah's Witnesses do in 1914, well, don't believe any of that. It's 2,000 years too late anyway. It didn't happen in that generation. They're wrong on two counts. But it isn't going to be like that. This coming of the Son of Man, everybody's going to see. Everybody's going to know about it. You can't hide that at all. So then he says in 28, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Now, I really brushed over this last week, so I'm doing a lengthy review and just got a little bit to add here tonight to kind of seal everything up. You know, let me say, there's two big ideas here. The vultures could be the Roman army, and they're feeding on the corpse of the Jewish polity, feeding on the corpse of the Jewish nation and Judaism, feeding on the corpse of all the good things that God tried to produce in them and that they, you know, had failed in. And so, feeding on that corpse. Now, I think the corpse is that, but I rather think that the vultures myself, brethren, are not the Roman army, but actually is the false teachers. I think that's who he's talking about. Wherever the corpse is, you'll find these false teachers. False teachers only flourish and destroy large numbers of people when the people are what? Ignorant, rebellious, and sinful. When they will not see the Lord. They don't understand who he is. They can't perceive it. They're blind to who he is. And so false teachers can proliferate as they do today. The guys that wrote the Left Behind books, totally false teachers. The stuff they wrote in that is a pack of lies. Hal Lindsey, J.N. Darby, all these guys, Schofield in his reference Bible, have all proposed ideas about the end of the world that are utterly at variance with Matthew 24. But they use Matthew 24 as their excuse for it. Remember I showed you in the Schofield reference Bible how he said that Matthew and Luke, which are recording the identical same event, one of them says Jerusalem will be spared and the other one says it's going to be destroyed. Remember that introductory class? How can you say such a thing? How can these identical words mean two opposite things, that Jerusalem will be destroyed and it won't be destroyed? It can't happen. False teachers, though, in the midst of enormous amounts of ignorance and, you know, just gullibility, have their sway and their way. And so, they were in the first century. And I think the vultures are the false prophets, misleading people everywhere in that time. Now, immediately, verse 29, after the tribulation of those days, after the tribulation of the days where Jerusalem has been surrounded by armies, the abomination of desolation stood in the holy place, and you fled the city. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then, note carefully how I read this translation, then the sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear. The scripture is most often translated there that the sign will be in heaven. An equally valid, I think very much better translation of the very same words, which by Greek, you know, can mean either one. It could go either way. But at least an equally valid translation is that it's the Son of Man in heaven that the sign represents. The sign's not in heaven. Jesus is. The sign is pointing at Him that He reigns from heaven. Now, of course, it finishes in verse 30. All the tribes of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Have those words been fulfilled in our past or not? Somebody say yes. Somebody say no. Okay. See, brother, most people reading the chapter say no. Because they look at verses 29 through 31, actually, I guess I should read that too. He'll send forth His angels with a great trumpet. They'll gather together His elect from the four winds from one end of the sky, the word is heavens, to the other. Now, in those three verses, most people say can't have happen. I'm going to take it literally and only literally. I will not allow this to be figurative or representative of anything else. I will take it literally and only literally, and I deny that that has happened. It has not happened. These verses are not talking about the fall of Jerusalem. At verse 29, Jesus got off that horse in the middle of the stream, and He went to talk about the end of the world. That's where huge numbers of people come, you know, to believe this passage changed its mind, where Jesus changed His mind. How would you answer that in a single verse to prove unquestionably that they must be wrong and that those verses have been fulfilled? Single verse. Where is it? 34. Because He went on to say in verse 32, now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender, puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is what? 2,000 years away? How near? Even so you too, when you see all these things, who's He talking to that will see all these things? Several times He said, you will see. He continues to say, you will see. Who's the you He's talking to? The apostles on Mount Olivet. When you see all these things, recognize that He is where? Near. At the door. 34. Truly I say to you, will not pass away until how many of these things take place? All these things. What things? These things. The these things, brethren, that they asked about. In verse 3, when they said, tell us when will these things be? The only things they're talking about is fall of Jerusalem. Nothing else has been introduced. There's been no change of topic. And verse 34 says so. Now, this I did not get into next week, and you really need to know this, because those who do not believe what Jesus said, They think that those words 29 through 31 are not yet fulfilled. They will not accept verse 34 as meaning what it says. First, point out to them Matthew 23 verse 36, which says exactly the same thing. And everybody agrees, even Schofield agrees, that in 23:36 he's talking about what generation? Jesus' generation. Now we get one chapter later, Jesus has hardly taken a breath, and he utters the identical same words to the self-same people. And uses the expression they asked in their question, these things, and says it's going to be in this generation. How do they respond who do not believe that those things happen in that generation? They say, the word generation here should be translated race, R-A-C-E. And what the verse says is that it's a guarantee that there will be Jews all the way to the end of the world. The race of Jews will never die off the earth. Now, I won't take the time to do it tonight. You can do it online. You can do it in Bible software. You can do it with Cruden's Concordance or Strong's. Never does that word mean that in the Bible or anywhere else. It does not mean race. It is a desperate and I think deceitful attempt by teachers who were consciously knowing that they were misleading to answer a question for which there was no answer. How can this not happen in this generation? And they came up with a redefinition of the word genea, which never means race. It is just cheating. Don't let people cheat you. The word means the same thing that the same word meant in 23:36. It means you bunch of people that are living here right now, this generation of folks. Now then, in 34, brethren, whatever you get out of 29 through 31, if you never understand what that means, if it just blows your mind 29 through 31, you can't begin to figure out what those words mean. Answer me this question. When were they fulfilled? In that generation. So I have to have some work to do to try to figure out what they mean, but I know when they were fulfilled, or Jesus is what? He's not the Son of God. He's not a prophet. He's a failure. He was wrong. A position many people take, maybe another 50% of the world, says, see, this never happened. Should also be well aware, brethren, that this passage is as popular for the atheist and the skeptic as it is for the premillennialist, you know, left behind types, the 40% of America that buy that this is talking about the end of the world. Because the atheist says, see, Jesus was wrong. Those things didn't happen in that generation. So now you've got to deal with 29 through 31. Now, I showed you how to do it. I gave you one chapter that has almost every single one of these terms in it. What chapter was that? It would give you an interpretive key to what each of these expressions, sun, moon, stars, shaken. What chapter did I give you that uses those phrases elsewhere in the Bible?
Isaiah 13,
which specifies it's a prophecy about Babylon, which specifies that the Medes and the Persians would be the fulfillers of that prophecy, and which shows us then that this was very common parlance for a Jew. This terminology meant to them that there would be a cataclysmic event. Like when we say it's a dark day. They just did it more poetically. So now then, brethren, can't go back over all of that. I gave you the verses, had a whole chart here, you know, fill the screen with every one of these references. Whether or not you ever understand what those words mean, though Isaiah tells us that this is common Jewish talk about the invasion of an army, you know when it was fulfilled because of verse 34. Now, this is perfect. Exactly what I wanted to accomplish tonight. Brethren, this passage is profoundly important. Repetition, repetition, repetition. So I have very consciously gone over this again and again and again. Because it is most likely, next to baptism, the one thing you'll have to argue the most in your life with people thinking that it's not talking about the fall of Jerusalem. And not realizing that if it isn't, then Jesus is not the Christ.
He failed if it did not all of these things take place in that generation. They did. Jerusalem was surrounded by armies and was destroyed. Not one stone was left upon another in that temple in September of 70 AD. But the big question for the remainder of tonight is the teaser I gave you in the bulletin on Sunday. After verse 34, did Jesus somewhere after verse 34 change the subject to the end of the world? Now, in the Lord's church, I don't mean denominational groups, but among us as churches of Christ, you'll find very many saints who think so. Now, I'm not going to be falling out with you. I certainly don't embrace that view. You know, I'm not going to kick you out of the church. Hope you'll give me the pass. But brethren, it's the big question. Okay, in the Lord's church, I just don't think I've ever met a soul who didn't understand that everything prior to verse 34 is talking about the fall of Jerusalem. But even we're divided after that. Did Jesus change the subject? Is there a transition? Does he say or do anything that would interrupt the flow of what he was talking about so that we would have some clue in the passage that he is moving from the circumstances that would take place in that generation to circumstances which have not even yet taken place 2,000 years later? Did he do this? It is this, brethren, which back in 1975 and following, when I came to the view that I've taught you in the last 3 weeks and tonight, I believe this since 1975. I have been looking for that transition since 1975. I've had a number of people suggest, well, maybe here, maybe there. I believe, brethren, I could answer any conceivable argument you could put up in that regard. But there is one that I want to deal with tonight, because it is the most popular, and therefore I guess you'd say the strongest. It's the one most people really cling to. And it goes like this. In verse 34, let's start there. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my word shall not pass away. Does verse 35 say that the previous 34 verses were talking about heaven and earth passing away? No. He mentions heaven and earth passing away, not because that's the topic. It isn't. He's trying to say my words are more sure than the planet. So if I tell you that not one stone here will be left upon another, then you better believe it more certainly than you've got dirt to stand on. What I say must endure and must come to pass. That's what he meant by that. He is illustrating, brethren, that his words will not pass away. He is not saying what I've been talking about is the end of the world, nor is he saying, now I'm going to change the topic and talk about heaven and earth passing away. Because, brethren, what next follows? But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days, which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. There shall be two men in the field. One will be taken, one will be left. Two women grinding at the mill. One will be taken, one will be left. Therefore be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this, if the head of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason you be ready too. For the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. What are all the verses, brethren, 36 through 44, about? There's one topic. It is specifically named four times. What's the topic? It's the topic is, be ready, because I'm telling you, the coming of the Son of Man is in this generation. I'm telling you, it's after the famine, the wars, and all that stuff in verses 3 through 13. I'm telling you that it's going to be in this generation, immediately after the tribulation, where you all have to flee Jerusalem when you see it surrounded by armies. Then is when the coming of the Son of Man will be. So note, brethren, that in verse 3, the disciples asked a question. When will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming? In verse 14, he said, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world, oikoumene, for witness to all the nations, and then the what shall come? The end of the age, brethren, that is the sign of his coming. And then it says, down at verse 27, just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the what? Coming of the Son of Man be. Verse 30, then the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. These signs prove that he reigns from heaven. They are signs that he's in heaven, not dead, not in Hades. Signs that he's in heaven. You'll see the sign down here. But then he says, the tribes of the earth will mourn. They'll see the Son of Man what? Coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. We looked at all those symbols from Isaiah 13. Let me just hit one more right here. Tribes of the earth. All the tribes of the earth. Just, well, he has to be seen by everybody on the planet. It's all the tribes of the earth. What is the word for earth in 24:30? And don't say oikoumene. Don't say cosmos. What is it? It is gates, brethren. It is gates. Please turn back in Matthew to chapter 2. Matthew 2, and look at verse 6. And you, Bethlehem, earth of Judah. We don't ever translate it that way, do we? No, but it's the exact same word. Look at chapter 2 at verses 20 and 21 of Matthew. Same gospel, same writer. Arise and take the child and his mother and go into the earth of Israel. Guess what the word is? Land. Gates of Israel. Those who sought the child's life are dead. He arose, took the child and his mother and came into the what? The gates of Israel. 4:15 does the same thing. Luke 21 does it. John 3 does it. Well, it happens in 24:30. Brethren, how many tribes are on the earth? Gaze, land.
12 tribes.
That's how many tribes. There's 12 tribes in that land. This condemnation is upon the Jews in their land. Okay? Now, back to the latter part of Matthew 24. What I'm trying to show you is, if there's a transition after verse 34, it's pretty hard to find. Jesus is using the exact same terminology that they asked about. The coming of the Son of Man to end the age. Coming of the Son of Man in 37. Coming of the Son of Man in 39. Lord is coming in 42. Son of Man's coming in 44. He's not changing the terminology. Here's something else to note, brethren. In Matthew 24, I briefly mentioned this, back at verse 9. You have the word then. That word appears 9 times in Matthew 24. That word appears at the start of verse 10 where it's translated at that time. Because that's what the word means. Then or at that time. That word, brethren, runs 9 times down through this passage. And you'll find it in verse 40. It's the same time. The same time, the same generation, the same coming. Then there'll be 2 men in the field. Everything is consistent. But the big argument, the huge one is, this must be talking about the end of the planet because it's like Noah's day. In Noah's day, was it a local flood or a global flood? It was a global flood. So they say, if it's like the days of Noah, then it has to be like that judgment. It has to be global.
Now, brother, that sounds powerful, doesn't it? It sounds strong. Jesus changed the subject there by introducing a global judgment with Noah. Now, brother, that's a good argument. That's a good argument. But let's look closely at this argument. It has to be global because Noah's judgment was global. Now, he does in fact say, in verse 37, the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. Just like. Just like. So, you have just learned that the end of the world will come with a flood. Right? Noah's judgment was a flood. If it's just like Noah's judgment, then what's it have to be? A flood. Noah's judgment had a boat. If it's going to be just like Noah's, then what? There must be a boat. And only 8 people were spared. If it's just like Noah, then what? There'll be 8 survivors. See a problem here? In the passage, he stipulates in what manner, how it is just like the days of Noah. It's not just like it that it's a flood. It's not just like it that only 8 survive. It is just like it in the manner stipulated. 37. Just like the days of Noah, for as those days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark. They didn't understand until the flood came and took them all away. So, in that manner, in that way, that's how it's just like it, shall the coming of the Son of Man be. The coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah in what respect? The great majority won't see God. They don't believe Jesus. They're not looking for those signs. They're not looking for it in this generation. They're not worried about the abomination of desolation when Roman armies surround Jerusalem, and they're going to be all surprised, and they're going to die as a result. Now, here's the biggie. Boom. I want to end the class with tonight. Okay. Now, brother, look. This same argument, most people say, he must have changed his mind to talk about the end of the planet somewhere after verse 34. And Noah doesn't, because it's global. Okay? They camp on it. There's another answer to this. And I think, brother, truly, it's just shocking. It's just stunning. It's in Luke, but it's not in chapter 21 at all. It's in Luke 17. It's in Luke at a different place and time. It is not Jesus on the Mount of Olives. It is not Jesus having just walked out of the temple and talked about the widow's mite and condemned the Pharisees and scared the apostles, you know, with the desolation of their house. It's in Luke 17 that we want to take up our study now. In Luke 17, let's start the reading at verse 22. He said to the disciples, "The day shall come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. And they'll say to you, 'Look there, look here.' Do not go away and do not run after them, for just as the lightning, when it flashes out of one part of the sky, shines to the other part of the sky, so will the Son of Man be in his day." Does that sound familiar? 25. "But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by" what? The race? Oh, this generation. 26. "And just as it happened in the days of Noah, so it shall be also in the days of the Son of Man." They were eating. They were drinking. They were marrying. They were being given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. It was the same as happened in the days of Lot. They were eating. They were drinking. They were buying, they were selling, they were planting, they were building, but on the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. It will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, Let not the one who is on the housetop and whose goods are in the house go down to take them away. Likewise, let not the one who is in the field turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to keep his life shall lose it. Whoever loses his life shall preserve it. I tell you, on that night, there'll be two men in one bed. One will be taken, the other will be left. There'll be two women grinding at the same place. One will be taken, the other will be left. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, the other will be left. And he answered them, saying to him, "Where, Lord?" And he said to them, "Where the body is, there also will the vultures be gathered." Does that sound familiar? But it's not on the Mount of Olives. It's maybe a year earlier. And material in the passage in Luke 17, which appears before Matthew 24:34, all these things shall take place in this generation. Material in Luke 17 that you have identically recorded in Matthew 24 before the this generation statement follows after the Noah statement in Luke 17. No transition from fall of Jerusalem to end of the world because he brings up Noah. Noah in Luke 17 has to be the fall of Jerusalem. And he's only referenced there because these people are blind. They will not say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." They don't get it. They won't be ready. And brethren, by the hundreds of thousands, they died and were enslaved. I'm glad we're done with Matthew 24. I still didn't quite finish it up. But what I'll leave you with is this. See if you can find a change of subject. See if after 34 there's any indication that the terminology changes, the subject changes, the time changes, just anything that will say, "I'm now going to talk about the end of the world." Brethren, it is not there. Jesus never got off that horse. Matthew 24 is about the fall of Jerusalem. Now, here's the teaser. We'll do it next week. I know I'm 1 minute over, but I just want you to see it. Come to Revelation 1. Come to Revelation 1, brethren, where it sounds like this. In verse 7, "Behold, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the tribes of the Gaze will mourn over him."